gone so long that now don't worry me. I've been down so long, now don't worry me. I just sit and wonder, where can my good man be? When it rains in here, it's storming on the sea. When it rains in here, it's storming on the sea. Time I come here, everything happens to me. I lose my man, I lose my head, I lose my money, feel like I'm almost dead. Need you bad as can be. I've been down so long that down don't worry me.
CITR 101.9 FM. Oh, I did not realize that song was ending. sorry about that, folks. Ink Studs, this is the radio show where we talk about... What do we talk about, Colin?
Well, comic books, if we can still use the term. Should it be graphic novels
now?
Oh,
we're not going to get into semantics today. that was Billie Holiday, Stormy Blues. Today, our special guest is Dinah Schutz. This is kind of ending our month of focus on women in comics. Diana, hello, Diana. We got you
hello.
On air. Hello. Diana's the, what's your title at Dark Horse currently? I'm confused because you were editor in chief and I guess the bureaucracy was a creative crutch. And so you're an editor or senior editor?
Actually these days I'm an executive editor.
Okay.
At Dark Horse.
There we go. But also a comics fan of many years and much involvement in the comics community, I guess, over the last 30 years now?
Yes, 30 years this year.
I was doing a little bit of research on your bio, and I read that you, 30 years ago, you were working at the lovely comic shop on 4th Avenue in Victoria, or in Vancouver.
Yes, although in those days it was at 4th and Alma. I can't remember when they moved to 4th and Arbutus, but when I first started working for them, it was 4th and Alma, 1978.
And at that time, you were a student, I understand.
I was. Well, actually, I was, when I went to work for the comic shop, I actually dropped out of grad school at UBC. I'd been studying philosophy, and I'd spent a lot of years in the ivory tower, had rediscovered my interest in comics while at UBC. And so I guess I became a pretty steady customer at the comic shop maybe a year or two after they had opened, and a couple years later I left school to go bag and tag comics at the store.
And you know, the career from a philosophy degree is probably about as engaging as a or as a economically fulfilling as working at a comic store?
Well, you know, I learned a lot of social skills, believe it or not, working at the comic book store that I had not learned in the university. But my university education stood me very well because I had studied creative writing. I got a bachelor's of fine arts in creative writing with a minor in philosophy. And then I went on to grad school in philosophy, which I ultimately did not complete. And so the writing background was very helpful to what I do now, obviously. But the philosophy background was even more critical because philosophy taught me how to think critically, how to troubleshoot, problem solve. And I use that every single day on the job.
I made the mistake in one class of saying that I take history in school and saying that, you know, really you can't do a lot with a history degree. And my prof was very adamant that, in fact, the critical thinking is the most important part of taking history as the being able to tear things apart and understand what really is at the meat, the bones of what makes an event function. What is it that causes these changes? I understand.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I mean, those are life skills, you know, because no matter what you do, you're sort of faced with those kinds of challenges every single day.
And as well, I worked in a comic store, and that helped me in my career as a drug and alcohol worker.
Do you want to explain that one?
Working with diverse folks with different issues. I love comic fans, but they're a weird group of folks, myself included.
We're a great bunch.
Now, I guess there's a bunch of stuff to cover with you, so I kind of maybe do a little bit about what got you into comics and how that was really a vocation that you wanted to follow through with.
Well, you know, I'd been reading comics ever since I was a kid. And unlike most little girls, I wasn't reading Archies or Funny Animals. I was reading the superheroes. And I read them right through until adolescence, at which point I kind of switched to romance comics. And then pretty much drop comics like a hot potato in favor of boys and cigarettes and alcohol. And really rediscovered comics, as I said, while I was at the university. You know, I was reading Plato and Kant and all those really hard guys. And Even before the comic shop opened its doors in 1974, I was haunting the secondhand bookstores for their nickel comics that they had, you know, just tossed into boxes in the back of the shop. So,
Were you reading any underground comics?
Not at that point. It really wasn't until I found the direct market, the comic shop. That I think I even learned about underground comics. But, you know, I mean, as soon as I discovered the comic shop and met Ron Norton and Ken Witcher, then owners of the place, along with a very good friend of theirs who became a very good friend of mine, Funk Carls, between the three of them, they turned me on to the undergrounds. In more ways than one, I want to say. But yeah, comics were immediately compelling. They gave me relief from all the really hard reading that I was doing at the university, and they were fascinating to me in ways that I probably couldn't have explicated back then, but that I think have to do with. Sort of an ongoing love of literature, And the idea that this is a kind of literature that communicates primarily visually. For me, that just holds kind of a boundless appeal. So, and I met people through comics. It's a wonderful, tight, albeit strange, community. And it was just, once bitten, that was it. I was not, I wasn't about to leave. So it kind of went from there. I started out working retail in 1978 and eventually moved from retail to the publishing side.
And the publishing is the predominantly editing work as well as putting together some anthologies. With the editing work, what kind of engagement do you do with the artists, and how has that really kind of inspired you as well as your own writing?
Well, boy, that's a big question.
I know, I just realized that it's like, that's a bunch right there.
Editing. Being an editor means that, at least at Dark Horse, different companies function differently. At Dark Horse, being an editor means that you are involved and responsible for a project from the minute sort of the idea comes into being. Somebody whispers it in your ear, or you have your own ideas or whatever. From that point all the way through to when the book goes to the printer, you are managing that entire process. As an editor, you're managing that entire process. You're responsible for the quality of that entire process. So at every single stage of production, you have to oversee what's being done. You have to make sure it's being done correctly. You're working with artists, and your job really is to translate their vision to the page in the way that they want, in the way that's best for the work. So, when you're depending on the artist that you're working with, it varies as to how much they want you to be involved or not.
How much hand holding?
When I first started working with Frank Miller, for instance, mm-hmm. It was on the fifth volume of Sin City, Family Values, and I had come on board as his editor at his request. This was following Bob Schreck's departure from Dark Horse. And Frank, whom I'd known since 1981, called and asked me would I be his editor since Bob was leaving the company. And we talked about it for a while, and I was a little worried that it might screw up our friendship. But we decided to give it a go. We decided to give it a trial 6 months and see how that went. And it's now 11 years later. I guess it's going okay. But he started work on Family Values, which was supposed to be a 48-page comic, and it just grew and grew and grew. And I didn't see a plot. I didn't see a script. I'd get phone calls from Frank every few days, and he'd say, "Oh, well, I'm drawing Miho kicking this guy's head off his neck, off his body, whatever, and she's wearing rollerblades." I would think, "What the hell?" And every now and then he would, this was maybe before email, certainly before Frank had the ability to scan images. So he would fax me a page, one page, completely out of context. And so I would just get like these little clues all through his working process and never really, you know, never really get the big picture until finally he was done. He was done. And it had gone from a, you know, 48-page comic to a 128-page book, graphic novel. And he's done, and he's sending all the artwork. And he calls and says, you know, you're going to have it tomorrow. And I explained, well, tomorrow I'm going to be working from home, which I do from time to time. I'm going to be working from home, so send it to my house. So next day, FedEx comes knocking on the door and hands me a package that, you know, when I took it, almost knocked me to my knees. It was so heavy. And there it was. There was the book. It was all done. I mean, everything was done. So compare that to working with someone like, say, Paul Chadwick on Concrete, who will send me a plot, and then who will send me what are called thumbnail breakdowns of the story, along with the dialogue kind of loosely lettered in. And then will send me full pencils, and then will send me finished inks, and then it goes to the letter. So again, the point here is that depending on the artist that you're working with, you get pulled in. You get pulled in at different stages of the work. You give them exactly what they want. You give them as little or as much of you and your help as they request, basically.
So was it nerve-wracking for you waiting for Frank Miller to finish and not knowing what he was doing, or did you have confidence?
In Frank?
Yeah.
I have total confidence in that. Look, I'm really lucky. I've sort of surrounded myself with people who know exactly what they're doing. With artists who know what they're doing, I don't have to worry about Frank Miller.
No, I think by that point it's been a couple of years in the field for him.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
He's not going to be passing on another issue of Power Man Iron Fist. I've been looking at all this old Marvel stuff lately. So.
But, you know, even in those early days, I mean, you look at Frank's early work, he knew what he was doing. I reread his Daredevils recently.
Well, they're fantastic.
They are fantastic, and they totally, you know, 30 years later, they totally hold up.
Well, it's that, you just see that difference once he takes over the writing. It's just like, bam!
Yep.
So, hate to use the cooking phrase there. Was it Emerald? Sorry. Now, Sexy Chicks, maybe we'll dive into that a bit because this is my Inkstud's focus on women in comics over the month. You'd previously done a couple of anthologies, The Happy Endings and the Autobiographics. Mm-hmm. Was this kind of a next logical step for you of something where you wanted to see, you know, a coordinated book that just felt like a solid thing covering a diverse range of what comics has to offer?
Chicks was all about my desire to work with a bunch of women. When I was getting into comics, there really were not that many girls working in the field. I'm remembering a famous comment that a friend of mine made when I first started working at the comic shop, and this is my friend Funk, whom I mentioned earlier, and I was working there, and he walked in and went past me and up the back stairs to go talk to the owners of the shop, and I heard about this later. He got upstairs and he looked at them and he said, "Who's the skirt?"
Who's a dame down
there? You know, there just were not that many women interested in comics back then, for a variety of reasons. So the kinds of things that I, back in my 20s, was so excited to see would be these anthologies featuring women cartoonists. I mean, these people were my role models, you know. And Trina, whom I believe you had on the show.
Spoke with her last week.
Last week, yeah. Trina had put out, well, she had edited women's comics, and I think the first comic that she put out was an anthology of women's work, her own included, called It Ain't Me, Babe. And So all those things were very inspiring to me at that time, showed me that, oh my God, there are not just guys drawing this stuff, there are women doing it too. And you know, I was never an artist and never interested in doing that, but I was interested in working in comics, and here were these women who were working in comics. So those things really meant a lot to me in my early days in the field. And so I wanted to do one of my own. I wanted to include the work of women who had inspired me back then, like Trina, like Lee Mars, and I wanted to include new women on the scene whose work was amazing and who, for one reason or another, were not getting the appreciation I thought they should. So it was kind of partly nostalgia, partly payback. Yeah.
It's interesting, the range of folks in it, because it's not a specific grouping of comics where, like, you know, the previous anthologies you mentioned, the Amy Babe and the women's comics, it's all underground stuff. Was that something you're trying to look for to make sure is, like, a really diverse range of folks?
Yeah, and I guess, you know, here's the thing about anthologies generally. They are, more than any other kind of entity, they are any kind of book entity, they are a real reflection of the editor's consciousness, the editor's tastes. And my tastes have always been kind of totally across the board. You know, I love commercial comics. I still read Batman. For God's sake, I'm 53 years old, and I still read Batman.
Don't feel bad.
I love the superheroes. I love commercial monthly comics, but I also, you know, I loved the underground. I adore alternative comics. So I have very small C Catholic tastes. And when I'm putting together an anthology, I tend to like to go for a wide variety. And yes, specifically with the women's anthologies, they had always, it seemed to me, been restricted to sort of the quote-unquote ghetto areas of women, you know, the undergrounds. Or you'd see, lately, you'd see just the alternative cartoonists. You didn't really get that kind of diversity that I was looking for. That appeals to me.
It's the quality and the diversity. I totally see. It's interesting because you'll have like someone like Gail Simone, and you also have someone like Colleen Coover, who are completely separate genres and entities in the field.
Yeah, and why? Because I like them both. So, and if for Gail, you know, this was a chance to tell stories that were, to tell a story that was not a superhero story, you know, something a little more personal and close to home. So that was, you know, it was fun for her. It was fun for me to see her doing something outside of her usual area, too. And, you know, generally with anthologies, I mean, anthologies are typically a really, really hard sell in the market. So you kind of have to do something to help sell them, and one of the things you can do is to build them around a specific theme. So autobiographics had been built around the theme of personal true stories, and those written and drawn by many people who had never done such a thing before, you know, like Matt Wagner, like Frank Miller. Even Will Eisner, all his autobio work had been sort of disguised. You know, he never used the first person I to tell a real story. You know, the dreamer, he takes on, I forget the name, he gives himself in The Dreamer and To the Heart of the Storm. Those are sort of semi-autobiographical, but they're presented as if they're not at all. So you build these stories around a theme. It gives the anthology a bit more of an identity. And with Chicks, the theme was basically, you know, comics about women, by women, for women, although much to my surprise and delight, a lot of men enjoyed the book as well. And again, you know, it helps with anthologies to have some people in there who are well-known enough to help sell the anthology so that you can also publish people who are not well-known and give them a chance to kind of break in a little bit.
Now yourself, you have a story in there as well, which is a rarity in the field. What was your idea of doing the prose piece for the anthology?
Well, actually, the prose piece is something that I had written in 1992. When I dropped out of grad school at UBC, it haunted me. You know, it haunted me for years because I had been really close to completing my master's degree. So when Mike Richardson, who owns Dark Horse Comics, when Mike moved me to Portland in 1990 to come to work for the company, I went back to school. And not to study philosophy at that point, but I began studying communication, and in particular visual communication. So, and it was a long haul. It was like one course per semester while I was working at Dark Horse. So it took about 3 years or so, 3 years and another semester, I think, to finally get a master's degree in communication studies. And I had written that particular story, Jeff Macy's Girls. I'd written that for a class that I was taking, a communication studies course that I was taking. And I'd always kind of liked it, and here's a trade secret about doing anthologies. I ran out of budget money, and I had a bunch of pages to fill, and I had just enough budget money left to maybe, you know, pay an artist for a couple of illustrations. So, and I wanted Amanda Connor. She had no time for anything, and I said, well, look, how about I just pay you to do a few illustrations for this story? And it kind of solved all the problems because it filled up the pages that I needed to fill. It got me Amanda Connor. it cost just the rest of the budget money that I had left to spend on the book. So that's why it's in there.
Mazel tov. I'm going to take a quick song break. I'm going to play the Beatles, if that sounds good.
That sounds great.
And then when we get back, we'll talk about more of your creative stuff with the Grendel story.
Okie doke.
Okay. So please Stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back.
She's not a girl who misses much. Oh, yeah. She's well acquainted with the touch of the velvet hand, like a lizard on a window pane. The man in the crowd with the multicolored mirrors on his hobnail boots, lying with his eyes while his hands are busy working overtime. A soap impression of his wife, which he ate and donated to the National Trust. I need a fix, 'cause I'm going down, down to the bits that I left up. Cause I'm gone down. Mother Superior jumped the gun. 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 Mother Superior jumped the gun.
Inkstud, CITR, 101.9 FM. That was the Beatles, Happiness is a Warm Gun. It's such a warm song. It always makes me happy hearing it.
This is what happens when you move to the States.
You know, it's a take, of course, on Charles Schulz's Peanuts, Happiness is a Warm Puppy. And I've just finished reading the Schulz biography, which is...
The controversial one?
Yes, well, the one that just came out last year, Schulz and Peanuts by David Michaelis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, in many ways, it's amazing. It's brilliant. He sort of takes as his premise something that Charles Schulz said years ago, which is that, you know, if you read the strips, you would get the story of his life. So the author takes that as the premise and basically goes through the entire life and shows how it is reflected through the strips. And he mentions in the book at one point, you know, the phenomenon of Happiness Is, which back in 67 or 68 really kind of took over the world. Snoopy in particular was, you know, the most popular character, you know, long beat out Mickey Mouse at that point. And he mentions, you know, the Beatles' take on Happiness is a Warm Puppy being Happiness is a Warm Gun, but he neglects to say what Charles Schulz thought of that.
Now we'll never know. We'll have to ask Jeannie. Apparently she, if I remember right, she wasn't too happy with the biography.
Yeah, I heard that too. I don't know. I had the great good fortune of meeting Jeannie just last October at Ohio State University. She was attending every 3 years. They they host a comic arts conference, and they invited me there to speak, and Jeannie was there, and I got to meet her, and she's just a remarkable woman, and she's really involved with the whole field of cartooning,
mm-hmm.
and very, very supportive and very, very nice. And I was glad to see that all of those qualities come through in the book. You know, there's not one mean word about her in there. So that's a good thing. But yes, I had heard that the family wasn't all that enchanted with the book. And you know, I mean, Charles Schulz was human, you know, and mm-hmm. he had his flaws, and like anyone else. And I guess I don't know if I'd like it if my family were examined under a microscope like that either. You know,
it's quite an epic biography mm-hmm. too. Like it's not light, from what
no,
I understand.
No, it isn't.
It's a bit of an undertaking.
It's very thorough.
I have no real proper transition here, but your Grendel story. I was like, how can I smooth this? Your Grendel story, I guess that was done 9 years ago it came out?
It was originally published in 1999. It was actually written in 93.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Now, for those people who don't know, Grendel is a pretty iconic character. And the interesting thing is it's such a, I guess, that it's a bit of a mental undertaking, like the character itself. It's all about the, I guess, the psychosis of the Grendel concept. Is that a good way of putting it?
I think that's a pretty fair account. Grendel was created by Matt Wagner back in the early 80s, in the early days of independent comics and creators being able to own and publish their own characters. And Grendel began as just this one individual, utterly amoral character. Amoral, but not without a certain charm.
Mm-hmm.
And the concept grew from there. It kind of exploded from there into being more an examination of people's dark sides and how they can take anyone over, not just that one specific character.
Mm-hmm. And the story you did was about the main Grendel, Hunter Rose's adopted daughter. And the interesting thing, like the character, there wasn't a lot of stuff with the actual character that he'd done in the comics at that point.
No, Matt had written a story about the first Grendel, written and drawn a story about his first Grendel, Hunter Rose, and this was Hunter's adopted daughter, as you said, and there wasn't in Matt's original story, there wasn't a great deal. There was some stuff leading up to the death of Hunter Rose, and then following the death of Hunter Rose, there were like three sentences, and I took those three sentences and turned it into a two-issue story. Yeah.
And the interesting thing that I've read outside of what you wrote with the characters, I always felt kind of uncomfortable with the relationship that she had with the other characters. Like, it was definitely a kind of a, trying to think of the right words to use, but like there's a certain idealism that both Hunter and Argent would kind of put on this one young girl. And I found it interesting that you've kind of taken that, if I'm reading right, taken that into the kind of how that affected her.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm not a writer. I'm really not. I think I'm an okay editor. Sometimes I think I'm a pretty good editor. Sometimes I'm rotten. You know, we all have our bad days. But I'm definitely not a writer. Writing is really, really, really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not anything I particularly enjoy doing. But sometimes, and I guess in part because I work in publishing, and I'm a voracious reader, sometimes you just have a story in you that needs telling.
Mm-hmm.
And Devil Child, which is the name of Stacy's story, was like that for me. It was just something in me that had to get out onto the page. I didn't make any deal to write the story. I didn't talk to Matt about it, who owns the character. I just sat down one day and started writing because I had to. I had to get it out of me. And so, yeah, it was a very mysterious kind of a process, really.
Would you need an editor for this, or can you self-edit?
Well, Matt was my editor. Matt was my creative editor, and I did the nuts and bolts editing work here, in other words, shepherding it through the production process. But Matt was definitely the creative editor. In fact, there's a funny story. I had written a first issue. I had originally intended this to be a 3-issue story, and I had written the first issue, and I gave it to Matt to read, and he didn't get back to me, and he didn't get back to me, and he didn't get back to me. And finally, you know, 3 weeks later, he called and he said, "Di, why don't you swing by after work? You know, I want to talk to you about the script." So, okay, good. Finally, he's read it. And I drive over there, and Matt's wife, who happens to be my younger sister, is conspicuously absent. So she's gone, and Matt's alone in the house, and I walk in the door, and the first thing Matt does is pour me a glass of wine, which, you know, in my sister's house, it's like, if I want something, I better go get it. You know? So Matt pours me a glass of wine, and it's like, oh, this is not good news. And it wasn't. He basically hated the script. It was a 24-page script. He tossed 22 pages of 24.
Wow.
So Ooh. I kept the 2 pages that he said worked and went back to the keyboard and reworked things. And so the story wound up being a 2-issue story. And from that first issue, that first aborted issue, I only used two pages. So, yes, Matt was definitely my editor.
Definitely a central role there.
Yes. Well, you know, they are his characters. And, in fact, I was really very lucky. Matt hasn't let anyone else write those characters.
Mm-hmm. And that's the fascinating thing about that, I guess, Grendel universe is that there is so much to it, but there's the central core aspects.
So, I'm sorry, say again.
I really enjoy the Grendel stuff, and I think it's interesting that the how everything's interrelated in this core massive world that he's created.
It is a massive world, and there have been other writers and mm-hmm. artists of Grendel, but no one has been allowed to write stories involving Hunter Rose except for Matt, who created that character. And the fact that he sort of allowed me to play in that world yeah, I was just very lucky. But, you know, I let him marry my sister. So.
No more awkward Christmas dinners. What was your choice with the, I'm presuming you had pretty much carte blanche as far as your getting your writer, your art arm, the artist and colorist. I found it interesting to choose someone who had previously worked on the title.
The story was always intended for Tim to draw, Tim Sale to draw. I've been working with Tim since 1987, in fact.
On the
Tim's
Amazon for Comico?
Comic book work was, I was his editor. So, you know, he came to me in a submission one day through the mail, and I sent his work to Matt and said, look at this guy, let's hire him. He's very good, and he is very good. And he's also a really wonderful person, and I love him dearly. And I always had Tim in mind as the artist when I was writing it.
Now, any future plans for writing, or has that demon been exercised?
God, I hope not. It really, you know, again, I'm not a writer. It's just like pulling teeth, and it's not anything that I enjoy. I do it when I have to, for work or whatever, or because I'm forced to, as in the case of this story that clawed its way out of me. But no. No, please.
Well, you tend to keep yourself pretty busy as it is with your duties at Dark Horse. You also are adjunct instructor?
Yes, and I start teaching again next week. I'm already freaking out. Since 2002, I've been teaching a course in comics, art, history, and criticism at Portland Community College. And I do that one term per year, though the last few years I've done it two terms per year. And given that my day job at Dark Horse is, you know, already extraordinarily demanding, when I'm in my teaching terms, I have no time to breathe. I mean, it's the teaching thing is kind of a labor of love. My students are at community college. They're sort of, most of them are in their 20s. And they like me, if they know comics at all, they abandoned them when they became teenagers. And so they, you know, and then they see this class is offered, history of comics, and they get all kind of jazzed, and they have this nostalgia thing going on, and oh wow, you know, I remember when I used to read X-Men or whatever. And then they come into my class and learn that that comics have grown up with them, and there are all sorts of wonderful things for them to read, like Will Eisner's work, or like Sin City or 300, or like Spiegelman's Mouse, for instance, you know. That, in other words, comics are not restricted to the superheroes,
mm-hmm.
That comics can be quite sophisticated, quite intricate and important literature. For me, it's sort of like preaching the gospel of the graphic novel. It really is a labor of love. God knows it's not very lucrative. We pay our teachers horribly, I'm sorry to say.
I'm somehow unabashed, I don't know, unsurprised by that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But that said, Portland Community College has been tremendously supportive, and in fact, they just added. I did a little bit of agitating, and as a result, they have now added another course, another comics-related course, to the art department, and this one will be an actual hands-on cartooning course taught by Jesse Recklaw, who is a... He was a Berkeley-based cartoonist who moved here to Portland.
I think I've read some of his minis, and he's pretty fabulous.
Yeah, he does this. He's syndicated in a variety of alternative newspapers with a strip called Slow Wave, wherein he interprets other people's dreams. Anyway, Jesse's a sharp kid, and I had him as a guest lecturer in one of my classes. And he really impressed the hell out of me. So I agitated to get him in and teaching hands-on cartooning. And so that will be happening starting this summer. And in the meantime, my own course has become last year it became a permanent course on the roster at Portland Community College, meaning that, you know, whether I'm around to teach it or not, they now, it's in the course catalog. They have to offer it. So
they got to find someone if you can't do it.
That's right. Well, in Portland, they won't have any trouble. No. There's a huge comics community here.
It's the bit of a cartoon mecca now, or cartoonist mecca.
Yeah.
Did you see that coming, or did it kind of surprise you after living there, working at Dark Horse?
I guess it surprised me because, you know, it's kind of like if you live with someone for 20 years, you know, that the aging is so incremental that you don't really notice the change. And it's only when you look at the photo from 20 years ago compared with the person now and you think, wow, okay. And, you know, when I was first moved here in 1990, there were a few cartoonists living here, but through the last 18 years, it's amazing the number of cartoonists who have moved to Portland and stayed here.
It's fascinating to me because, like, Portland's not that different from Vancouver, but going to Stumptown last year was just kind of overwhelming, the amount of comics folk. And we have a decent little scene here, but it's nowhere near that many little scenes that Portland has.
Well, Dark Horse has grown tremendously. You know, when I was brought here to work, there were 10 people working here, and only one other woman and she was the receptionist, you know. So, and now the company is well over 100 people. And there are a lot more women working here and a lot more women editors, too. So Dark Horse has grown tremendously, and that's made a difference. When Bob Schreck left Dark Horse, he formed Oni Press here in town, and though he left Oni a few years after that to go to work at DC, Oni has also brought in, you know, the fact of their being located here in Portland has brought in other cartoonists to the area.
Mm-hmm.
Brett Warnock, who is one half the publisher of Top Shelf, is located here in Portland. So, you know, you have three sort of major publishers here in Portland. And Jim Valentino, one of the co-founders of Image Comics and its former publisher, moved to Portland about a year and a half ago. So you know, you have really four...
Everyone's
four
flocking.
...publishers right here in town, and that... That's always a draw.
Well, it's like Seattle in the 1990s. It was all about Fantagraphics and everybody rushing to town.
Exactly. Is that you, Colin?
To be part of that scene.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're going to be doing portfolio reviews at Stumptown.
Oh, God help me.
Okay, we'll just leave that there.
Look, portfolio reviewing is very painful. What can I say? You know, it just is. but again, it's all part of this payback thing, and I think that's really, really important. In 1978, when I first started working in comics, Ron Norton and Ken Whicher opened a huge door to me at the comic shop. When I moved to the U.S. in 81, when I immigrated to the U.S. in 81, the late John Barrett and Bud Plant, who co-owned Comics and Comics, opened another door to me. In 1984, when I moved to New York, Chris Claremont and Frank Miller helped me get into Marvel Comics for my famous 1 week on the job before I quit in terror.
But you still have your soul.
I'm sorry?
But you still have your soul.
More or less. So the point is that, you know, people helped me when I was young and trying to get in, and I feel a responsibility to help other people now who are in the position I was in 30 years ago. You know, it's karma or whatever. It's just something that you have to do or not be human, you know. So portfolio reviewing is part of that. Teaching is part of that. Doing anthologies and publishing people who have never had their work in print before is part of that.
It's a whole community milieu with so many different aspects to take on.
Yeah.
On that note, our hour is up. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was my pleasure.
And I guess have a swell evening, and I'll see you at Stumptown.
Yes, you will. I'll be there.
I'll be wandering the floor, spending too much money on too many mini comics.
You and me both.
Thanks, Anna.
Robin. Colin.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Diana Schutz, was it executive editor? Senior editor? Executive editor. Colin's correcting me. Dark Horse Books, as well as Fantastic History and Comics. She's really one of the more respected folks in comics. Everyone has something good to say about her, and I want to thank her for taking the time to join us. Next week, our show will be a focus on Stumptown with coordinator Indy Kelly. I don't know how to pronounce his name. He'll be joining us, as well as special guests Tara McPherson, Larry Martyr, and Dave Roman, who are all headlining guests at Stumptown. Up next, Crimes and Treasons. I'm going to end with some Diana Krall. And yeah, see you later, folks.